Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Supreme Court Consideration of EPA Mercury Standards webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in the listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press star, followed by the 1 on your telephone. If you need to reach an operator at any time, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Monday, March 23, 2015. I would now like to turn the conference over to Vicki Patton. Please go ahead.
Thank you. This is Vicki Patton. I serve as General Counsel at Environmental Defense Fund. Thank you for joining this discussion. We will also hold a briefing after the Supreme Court's oral argument that will take place on Wednesday at 1 o'clock. As you know, the High Court will take up and hear oral arguments in the consideration of EPA's mercury and air toxic standards for the nation's power plants Wednesday morning beginning at 10 o'clock. So the post-argument briefing will take place at 1 o'clock immediately after the arguments conclude. Contaminants discharged from our nation's power plants that are the most hazardous are the essence of what is at issue before the High Court on Wednesday. Mercury, arsenic, acid gases are toxic contaminants that have a suite of very serious human health impacts, including affecting the tens of thousands of children who are born each year with mercury levels that impair their brain development. Our nation's power plants are the single largest source of these hazardous air pollutants in our country. Other major source categories have made major reductions in these very contaminants, using, in many instances, many of the same control technologies that power plants are being asked to deploy these emission standards. There are a host of power plants across our country that are well on the way to compliance with these important health standards, and so this case comes at a time when our nation has made tremendous progress in deploying well-designed, cost-effective solutions to protect human health and the environment from mercury, arsenic, and acid gases. We're delighted to have with us today Dr. Lynn Goldman, who has spent her career studying the toxicological effects of mercury on human health as a pediatrician, as an epidemiologist. She serves as dean of the George Washington School of Public Health. She filed an amicus brief in this case together with other leading scientists on the human health effects of mercury. We're also joined by Ricky Revesz. Dean Revesz serves as dean emeritus at NYU School of Law. He's also director of the Institute for Policy Integrity. The Institute for Policy Integrity filed an amicus brief in this case. And Professor Revesz was also cited by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the opening passages of her opinion in April of 2014, affirming EPA's cross-state air pollution rule in the EME Homer City case. Sean Donahue, who serves as counsel of record in this case on behalf of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Lung Association, the Environmental Defense Fund, the NAACP, and many other groups, is with us as well today. Sean Donahue has participated in a number of major Clean Air cases before the High Court, and he argued this very case below in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Thank you all so much for joining us. We're going to begin with Sean Donahue providing a very brief overview of the legal issues that are presented in this case.
Thank you, Vicki, and thanks, everyone, for listening today. So in the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act, Congress strengthened the program for dealing with these air toxics, hazardous air pollutants, a category of pollutants that raise especially serious health concerns and that are sort of regulated the most stringently of any category under the Act. Congress was frustrated that EPA had moved very slowly in identifying hazardous pollutants and regulating them, and so Congress itself listed over 180 chemicals and directed EPA to regulate major sources of them. Those 1990 amendments treated power plants differently. Instead of treating them like the other sources, the amendments directed that EPA within 3 years perform a study of the hazard, the health hazards that EPA saw from emissions of air toxics from power plants, and directed that EPA shall regulate if, after considering the results of that study, the administrator determined that such regulation is appropriate and necessary. The reason for that special delay in study approach for power plants was that some in industry argued in 1990 that power plants, mercury and other air toxic emissions from power plants were not, in fact, a serious health problem, or that to the extent they were, that the new acid rain program that applied only to power plants and was enacted in 1990 would adequately address that health problem. So EPA did, over an extended period, conduct a series of very detailed and peer-reviewed studies in which it concluded that, in fact, emissions of mercury and other hazardous pollutants did represent serious hazards to public health, and that emissions of these pollutants had not decreased significantly as a result of the acid rain program, and, in fact, in some cases had increased since 1990. So in 2000, EPA determined that regulation of power plant toxic emissions was appropriate and necessary. And then in 2012, EPA reaffirmed that determination. And following the same approach that has been successfully followed for scores of other categories of major industrial sources, from refineries to chemical plants, EPA developed emissions standards based upon controls that are already in widespread use throughout the industry. And our view in this case is that EPA did exactly what the statute contemplated for power plants. It looked carefully at the evidence, the scientific evidence about health impacts and emissions, and based on that evidence, it properly determined that regulation was appropriate and necessary. We think EPA's interpretation of what is appropriate in this context is fully consistent with the statutory structure, which is clearly intended to protect public health, and that EPA's reading of the statute easily merits deference under well-settled law about judicial review of agency decision-making. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Sean. Dr. Goldman?
Yes, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about this today. Mercury, of course, is one of several toxic contaminants that are emitted by these power plants, also including arsenic, acid gases, and as a byproduct of the combustion particulate matter. But mercury itself was at the center of congressional concern in 1990 when a bipartisan Congress enacted this provision. And it's a long-standing concern because of the fact that it is toxic to the brain, to the nervous system. Since 1990, the science on mercury has advanced remarkably. What we know is that the mercury that is emitted by power plants, which comes out in an inorganic or an elemental form, is then transformed into something called methyl mercury, an organic form of mercury that then can accumulate in the body, and particularly is toxic to the brain and is especially a risk to the fetus. And so I think that some work has been needed to be able to trace how mercury is moving in the environment. And the amazing thing is that through the ability to do what's called isotopic fingerprinting of the mercury that's in various sources of coal and other sources, that studies have even been able to trace the emissions from these power plants to the methyl mercury that's found in regions globally, but particularly it's found in hot spots that are close to power plants. And so this is a problem with local impacts that are near range, but also global impact, where actually mercury that's from coal burn in power plants in the U.S. can be traced all the way to the Arctic. And what happens is that this compound methyl mercury accumulates in fish, and that's the major way that we are exposed to it, which is a great concern because of the fact that fish itself is a beneficial food and one that we in public health want to see people consume. That it especially has benefits to the health of newborns. And so it's ironic that if the methyl mercury is with the fish, that these benefits from fish consumption can be offset by the toxicity of methylmercury. But we also now know, since 1990, about a lot of other health effects from methylmercury. There are toxic effects on adults, people who consume a large proportion of their diet from fish that is high in mercury. There are also cardiovascular effects that we're observing now with increased blood pressure with exposure to methylmercury. So it's, as you can imagine, it's difficult to monetize all these effects, even when there are serious impacts across the population. What EPA did, I think, rightly in its analysis, its health analysis for the mercury air toxic standard, is that it particularly focused on these well-established effects on the brains, developing brains of newborns, particularly some of the studies that show actual reduction in IQ that seems to persist through childhood and into adulthood for these individuals. And then was able to do a very nice analysis that does demonstrate that this is a significant public health problem, not only with a major impact on the IQ of people across the population, but also a financial impact in terms of the impact across the population.
Thank you very much, Dr. Goldman. Dean Rivez?
Thank you. So this is the fourth case in the last 15 years in which the Supreme Court considers the question of what happens with a statute that's silent with respect to whether costs have to be taken into account. In one of the cases, the first case in 2001, Whitman versus American Trucking Associations under the Clean Air Act, the court held that silence under another provision of the Clean Air Act had to be interpreted as precluding the agency from taking costs into account. And in the next two cases, a case called Entergy under the Clean Water Act, and then last year, a case called EME, Homer City Generator, under the Clean Air Act, the court held that silence meant that the agency got discretion about whether to take costs into account or not. Here, the challengers to the rule are arguing that silence should mean that the agency is required to take costs into account, and the court has never done that in the four cases in which it's considered this question. In two of them, it said it was the agency's choice, and in one of them, it said the agency was precluded from doing that. The second point is that in this case, EPA did consider the costs and benefits in determining the stringency of the rule, and it just did not rely on the costs and benefits in deciding that it was appropriate and necessary to regulate the mercury and other toxic emissions of power plants. And when it considered the costs and benefits, EPA found that the benefits vastly exceeded the costs. The benefit ranges from $37 billion to $90 billion, and the cost is estimated at $9 billion. So it's sort of the benefits are greater than the cost by a factor of 4 to 10. Now, the opponents argue that most of those benefits should be ignored because they are co-benefits, meaning they are not benefits coming from the reduction of mercury and air toxics, but benefits coming from the reduction of other pollutants, in this case particulates. And there is no plausible basis for doing that. EPA followed the standard approach taken by administrations of both political parties going back decades. In fact, the approach to this is embodied in a OMB circular by the Office of Management and Budget that was promulgated in the Bush administration. It says that co-benefits have to be counted in cost-benefit analyses in the same way as direct benefits. And in fact, the challengers go even further and say that indirect costs have to be taken into account, but not indirect benefits. And there is absolutely no plausible way of justifying that. So what the agency has done here is consistent with the approaches taken by administrations of both parties. It's consistent with the best understanding of how cost-benefit analysis should be conducted. And there's really no plausibly defensible argument in favor of the challenger's statements about how cost and benefit should be taken into account.
Thank you for those comments. Operator, would now like to turn it over to questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press star followed by the 1 on your telephone keypad. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the pound key. One moment, please, for the first question. And we have no audio questions at this time.
Let's wait another minute just to see if there are any further questions. Any?
Okay, there is one from Lydia Wheeler.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for doing this call. I appreciate it. I'm Lydia Wheeler with The Hill. Was hoping that somebody could touch on, you know, kind of what are the overall ramifications of, I mean, what could happen if the Supreme Court, you know, decides to abolish this rule or in fact, uphold this rule? I mean, can someone talk to kind of what the ramifications will be of this court case or could be of this court case?
Okay. Thank you for your question. Sean or Richard, would you like to take that up?
This is Sean. I'm happy to say a little bit. Just first of all, I mean, this rule is an extremely important rule, as Dr. Goldman suggested. The health consequences of these pollutants are very serious, and these power plants dwarf all other sources of a lot of these pollutants, including mercury. And so it's a very significant public initiative. So that's one thing. That is very important. Now, we believe EPA's arguments are extremely strong for the reasonableness of what it did here, particularly on the question that the court is considering. If the court were to find fault with EPA's treatment of costs, what would normally happen is there would be some sending of the case back to the agency for further consideration. Now, here, as Dean Revesz pointed out, the agency has already taken a very close look at the costs and benefits of the rule. And so if the court were to conclude that EPA missed a step in the process that it should have done in terms of making a formal finding about costs and benefits as part of its finding under the Clean Air Act, I think we'd be very confident that EPA would see the facts the same way, that this rule is massively cost justified. So I think it would mean that EPA would have to do another step, but I think it would be overwhelmingly likely that the rule would ultimately stand up because the underlying science is really robust. The compliance, we're almost there now anyway. And in fact, there are some very large companies that are present in court as respondents next to EPA urging the court to uphold the rule because they have already cleaned up and it's actually harmful to them to have a relatively small fraction of the industry able to operate without controls because it's cheaper. But even, you know, there's a broader cross-section of industry that is already meeting the standard. So I think the ultimate prospects for this rule are very, very secure. The question is whether EPA will have to do some more work, and we're pretty confident that EPA's legal arguments are very strong.
Can you repeat again what the costs and benefits are again? I mean, I think you said $90 billion is what the
EPA is okay,
so,
the benefit.
So EPA is, Dean Revesz, why don't you, take that one?
The benefits range from $37 billion to $90 billion, and the costs are $9 billion. And,
okay.
And just one other point, that's just the quantified benefits. There are significant benefits that EPA was not able to quantify because the quantification techniques have not been sufficiently developed, but that nonetheless EPA relied on and relied on appropriately. And the challengers essentially make the argument that those unquantified benefits shouldn't be taken into account at all, which is also inconsistent with the standard policies for conducting cost-benefit analyses by administrations of both parties for several decades. But the quantified benefits exceed the quantified costs by a factor of between 4 and 10.
Thank you.
Thank you for that question. Are there additional questions?
Yes, your next question comes from the line of Jeremy Jacobs. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, guys. Thanks for doing the call. This is Jeremy Jacobs from Greenwire. I wanted to ask, and I don't know how much you guys want to talk about this, but maybe speculate a bit on why the court took this up to begin with. Ricky, you mentioned the Entergy decision. That was a challenge by environmentalists, and they deferred to the agency's decision to do a cost-benefit analysis in that Clean Water Act case. And that was, the majority was the conservatives. Is there a possibility that we could see something out of the conservative wing that would mandate such a cost analysis going forward?
I doubt it. And also last term in EME Homer City
Generator, right,
that was a case where the agency had taken costs into account. And it was basically the industry groups that argued that silence meant that the agency was precluded from taking costs into
mm-hmm.
account. And now essentially the same industry groups are arguing that silence, I mean, admittedly under a different provision of the Clean Air Act, but silence nonetheless means that the agency is required to take costs into account. So they've done a 180-degree about-face on their position, whereas
mm-hmm.
EPA is consistent. The EPA has consistently taken the position in Entergy and in EME Homer City Generator that silence means EPA gets discretion. It's a real awkwardness for the position that the industry groups are
mm-hmm.
pushing. It's hard to
okay.
speculate why the court granted cert. You know, four justices can grant. Those votes aren't public. They aren't explained. It's obviously an important regulation. There might be, you know, many reasons, but I don't think that we can read from the cert grant any particular proclivity on the merits. I think that what we have going for us are the precedents, and the precedents are one case in which silence precludes taking costs into account, and two cases in which silence means the agency gets discretion, and zero cases in which silence means the agency is required
right.
to take costs into account.
Okay, thanks very much.
Jeremy, thank you for that question. Next question.
And as a reminder to register for a question, press the star followed by the 1. And there are no further questions at this time.
Okay, we will wait just another moment and would welcome further questions. Thank you all again for joining this briefing. We will have a post-argument briefing again at 1 o'clock. We'll get that call-in information around. I want to thank Dr. Goldman, Professor Revesz, Sean Donahue for their expertise in joining this discussion, and look forward to the arguments at the High Court on Wednesday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.